Plenty to grab your attention on the radio today. This is Playback Daily. I'm Carol Moran, and here's what you might have missed.
If I was to go into a building where there was someone lying down bleeding, I would step over them and try and reassure them I would be back. But my job is not to help and assist those who are wounded, but rather to go and eliminate the threat before they can kill more people.
We should tell people that there is a happy ending. You were successful, which is fantastic.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, 80 grand later. 80 grand later, okay?
So 80 grand, wow.
80 grand later.
How much is the price of clothing increasing by, Adam?
The price of clothing was 1.1% higher in the year, so not too dramatic. But it also showed that prices had jumped by 4.2% in the month from April to March. So a huge jump in just a couple of weeks.
And we'll start with today with Claire Byrne. After the school shooting atrocity in Texas, Claire was talking to New York police officer Mark Kerwin, originally from Tipperary, about gun control in the States.
Families of the 21 victims of Tuesday's mass shooting at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde in Texas are still coming to terms with the devastating news, and further details have emerged about the exact circumstances surrounding the shooting. Reports today say that frustrated onlookers urged police to charge into the school to stop the attack as it was going ahead. The massacre has reignited a long-running debate in the US on gun control, and Tipperary man Mark Kerwin is a police officer in Washington, D.C. and is on the line now. Mark, thanks very much for taking our call. We really appreciate it.
Good morning, Claire. Thank you.
So you can't foresee, despite what we saw unfolding over the last couple of days, you can't foresee any gun reform in the United States after this latest massacre.
I really can't, Claire. I don't see it in my lifetime or the next generation's lifetime. You know, in fact, looking at Texas, they've taken steps backwards. They've the most permissive gun law in the country. They've recently, in the last 10 years, passed legislation loosening the gun laws, where now anyone over the age of 21 doesn't actually even need a gun permit and can openly carry anywhere in the state. Mm-hmm. So it's a backward trend. And one of the issues is that, you know, the governor of Texas, he wants Texas to be a Second Amendment sanctuary state. And he looks at anyone who is an active shooter or uses a gun wrongfully as a crazy person, which is the completely wrong attitude to have. You know, there's two things really to take into review here. One is gun laws, and the second is the accessibility to guns. And the issue that we're having is that people aren't seeing the red flags, that there's not enough emphasis on mental health. And that's something that really needs to improve.
Yeah, I mean, I heard part of the governor's press conference, Greg Abbott, where he spoke again and again about mental health. But surely the problem is that an 18-year-old on the day of his birthday can walk into a Walmart and buy these rifles, these high-powered rifles that are weapons that you'd use in the heat of battle in a war situation. That's the problem, surely. We have mental health issues all over the world, but we don't have children getting shot in their classroom.
And that's my point, where one of the issues is accessibility to guns. You know, if you look at it, since there's been 1,536 people shot and killed in mass shootings, 950 shot and wounded. And a lot of people, there's a lot of sort of grey area here, because what is a mass shooting? A mass shooting is where four or more people have been shot, not including the shooter. If you look at it, 32% of shooters end their lives themselves by shooting themselves, by suicide. You know, one in three mass shooters were legally prohibited from possessing firearms at the time of the shooting. One of the common traits with mass shooters is that there is a history of trauma in their life. If you look at in Texas at the shooting, the 18-year-old used social media, which is also another thing which they're all doing. They're actually radicalizing themselves online, being radicalized online by previous shooters, mass shooters. He said that he was going to kill his grandmother, which he did, or he shot her. He stole his grandmother's vehicle and said that he was going to an elementary school to shoot people.
Mm-hmm.
The other issue is training as well. I firmly believe that what's needed is a red flag law. And what I mean by that is where a judge can make a decision to enforce local law enforcement officials to go in and take away guns from people who are a threat to themselves and to others.
And Claire asked Mark about his own experience with gun crime.
But just, can I talk to you about your own situation? Because this is a feature of your working life, isn't it? You come across these types of situations as a police officer.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I was on the active shooter team myself, which is, you know, we go through training in DC for active shooting twice a year. It's something that we've, for the last 15 years, more or less, we've taken very seriously, so much so that we've actually built an entire village inside of our academy where we train every year, where we have mock-like shops, schools, office buildings, and we train how to go into them, how to go and get the target. And years ago, people, when there was a shooting, the first thing you did when you entered the building was to attend to those who were hurt and injured. But as the years have gone on, our training now teaches us to go straight away and get the threat and eliminate the threat. So in other words, if I was to go into a building where there was someone lying down bleeding, I would step over them and try and reassure them I would be back. But my job is not to help and assist those who are wounded, but rather to go and eliminate the threat before they can kill more people or wound more.
And Mark, I'm sure you've been looking at the detail that has been emerging from this shooting in Uvalde. And I'm not sure if we're crystal clear on what exactly happened, but we do hear that there were parents outside, concerned citizens, as this thing was unfolding, urging law enforcement to go in and stop it. Are you any clearer on what happened over the course of those few hours?
Well, obviously the investigation is still taking place, and there are people who are, you know, emotionally distraught and maybe not thinking right. Everyone is just so emotionally distraught over this, especially those who witnessed it. And so I can't speak on behalf of the law enforcement that were outside. But I know it's a very small town. It's a 16,000 population town, very small police force. So I'm not sure what level of training that police force has had. But I can assure you that from my training, from the Metropolitan Police Department in DC, when an active shooter takes place, we go in as a team instantly, basically. As soon as we have enough people there, we've all been trained in and out, we know each other, and we will go in straight away to try to eliminate the threat. Mm-hmm. And not wait for what some people would consider or call a SWAT team or an emergency response team. Nowadays, every officer on the street is trained as an active shooter. So you no longer rely on a specialised team to come in and wait for them to come in. So I'm really not sure what locally they did. I do know that there were several different agencies that came in and eliminated the threat. But I can't speak on behalf of the local department, you know.
Yeah, I know that. But you can imagine what they were facing. You know, this guy barricading himself into a classroom with all those children and the teachers, and you as the law enforcement officer, you've got a choice to make.
Well, you also have to realise, Claire, when you have such a small community, a small population in that town, that probably some of the law enforcement that were standing outside have either, you know, kids in that school, wives, husbands as teachers in that school. Everyone knew each other there. It was so small, such a small community. So it's a bit different than a major city, than a, you know, every situation is so different, you know. I attended the Navy Yard shooting in September 16th on 2013, where a shooter went in the Navy Yard in Washington, D.C. and killed 13 people. There's no two that are the same. And one of the issues we have now is the person acting alone? Or, you know, because we're getting too familiarized with these shootings. So we need to, every time there's a shooting, sadly, we need to deeply analyse it and see, you know, what are the changes? Are they copycat shooters? Or if there is someone else working with them, well, then you're going after one threat and there could be another threat.
Mm-hmm. Mark Kerwin from Today with Claire Byrne. And in the afternoon on Liveline, after the Sue Gray report on Partygate and apologies issued to cleaning staff at 10 Downing Street, Katie was talking about the lack of respect shown to cleaning staff in general.
And we've been looking at the Sue Gray report. Obviously, a long-awaited Sue Gray report into the Partygate scandal in the UK. And we're told that Boris Johnson has had to offer an apology to number 10 security and cleaning staff for their appalling treatment, which was revealed in the report. Of course, we heard stories about vomit, about red wine stains, but also about lack of respect and multiple incidents where of poor treatment, that was how it was described, of poor treatment of security and cleaning staff. Linda, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Katie.
You're not surprised, Linda, at what's in that report?
Not at all. I worked as a cleaner since the 70s, both full-time, part-time, and some people are lovely, really nice, and other people just look down their nose, and I will walk away because I'm worth the respect as far as I'm concerned. But people, when you work in office cleaning, it's obviously very different from working in a private home cleaner. And in offices, some of the people, you're just appalled by their behaviour.
And Linda, just to explain, you're talking about working in Ireland, in Dublin?
Yeah. I've worked both in Dublin and the UK, and actually there's no difference between people's attitudes. Some people, you know, they're marvellous about it. They accept that you've got a job to do, you're doing it, that's all they want. And there's other people just have to look down their noses at you because you're just the cleaner, you know, and I have a skill set.
Yeah, and a very valuable skill set. And it's very hard work.
Yeah, you know, it's physical work. And as I say, you have to know what you're doing. You have to know the order to do it in. You know, and I don't understand why people sort of feel that, I'm somehow better than you because, especially as, you know, as I pointed out to one guy who was sort of giving me gift, A, this is my second job because I'm saving up for a holiday, and B, I'm actually an engineer, so what's your point?
Are you actually an engineer? Are you you qualified as an engineer, Linda?
Yeah.
And
I took up cleaning as a part-time job when, you know, wages were low. It was a handy way of earning money that I could set aside. It wasn't part of my wages, so I didn't have to account. So I could spend about 9 months a year doing a second job, working the evening hours, and it was handy. And then after my child was born, it was so hard to try and find a job to fit in around childcare, school, all the rest of it. I took up cleaning full time. Yeah, you know, the pay, funny enough, as a private cleaner, the pay was comparable.
And you could get as well paid working as an engineer as you could, or working as a cleaner as you could as an engineer?
Probably not as much. No, obviously not as much, but I didn't want to commit to full time work. And obviously, as an engineer, I've got to be able to do full time, overtime, things like that. As a cleaner, I could set my hours, so I could only, you know, I decided I was only going to work mornings, I'd be at home in the afternoons for my children,
and so, yeah, you could work around it.
We could afford it.
And tell me, have you ever, again, I'm coming back to that Sue Gray report, have you ever had to clean up after an office party?
A couple of times, mostly fine. But it's not just office parties. I literally walked into, I used to clean an office block, and I opened the toilet and I just stood there, turned around, walked up to my supervisor, said, I'm not going in there, it's a health hazard. And it was covered in diarrhoea.
The toilet was covered in diarrhoea?
Yeah, and it was dried. So it'd obviously been there a few hours. Nobody had contacted anybody to say, look, could you, you know. And they actually, the company I worked for, had a special group because it was a health hazard. So they had to send for the special cleaners to come in to clean this And people had obviously walked through this because you could see footprints. So we spent we spent time going around checking the carpets because there was brown footprints on the carpet.
Oh, well, Linda was then joined by former cleaner Mary.
Yeah, you were a cleaner in the Department of Defence.
I was, yes.
And how was that?
Pardon?
How was that, Mary?
Oh, well, I had no problems. Nobody, I was treated the same as everyone in the building.
Did they have any parties in there?
Oh, yeah, there was a few. The army used to cook lovely food. That's what I liked about it. They used to cook lovely meals. there wasn't parties as such. They'd have kind of do's on, but there weren't parties, you know?
Right, there was no vomit stains or red wine stains to be looked after.
No, I don't know.
And tell me, Mary, did you ever feel like anyone was looking down their nose at you, like Linda was describing there?
Never. I didn't experience anything of that, anything like that.
And you had no qualms telling people what you did?
No, it was a job. The view I took was an honest job.
That's Mary and Linda on the live line with Katie Hannan. And on the Ryan Tuberty Show, Emmy-nominated singer and producer Michael Londra was talking about his American success, his love of live performance and his mother's whistles.
Well, let me introduce you to Mr. Michael Londra. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, sir.
How are you? Nice to meet you and thanks for being with us this morning. You are making quite a splash in the United States of America, and we'll get to all of that in due course. But just in the 30 seconds or the minute or so we've spoken to each other, we've landed on several points of interest, beginning with chips, because you're a Wexford man.
Rissoles and chips, most important if you're from Wexford.
What are they?
Rissoles. They're like potato, spiced potato fried cakes. They're gorgeous, soaked in salt and vinegar with the chips. You'll only get them in Wexford town. They're magnificent.
How do you spell that?
R-I-S-S-O-L-E, Rissole.
Oh, Rissole. Oh, I think my mother used to make those.
Oh, they're magnificent.
They sound delicious. Yeah. I mean, why are we so into this so early in the morning? Chips and the power of a suggestion.
I live in Iowa, a million miles away from fish and chips. So when you talk about chips, I'm all in. Yeah, it's the first thing I'll have tonight.
It's funny. I was talking to someone who just back from the States and was having sausages, Irish sausages, and said, the food in America just doesn't compare. Like, she was so proud to be eating Irish food and going, it just tastes better, it's more earthy. Is that a generalisation or is it true?
Well, no, I think it's true. 20 years ago it wasn't true, but food is transformed in Ireland, and I talk to Americans because of my business about the food in Ireland all the time, and I'm super proud. In every small little town in Ireland there's some amazing place to eat.
Always. But that's not why we're here. Yeah. Mind you, speaking of which, I was in I went to a little restaurant near me yesterday with my daughter at about lunchtime, obviously, to get some lunch. And it was really full. They said 20 minutes late. Wait, we said, I know, Grant, we'll head home. But there was a man sitting in the corner with his laptop who's always, not there all the time, but pretty much nearly all the time. And I went in to pay my respects because I admire him very much. And he is somebody you know very well. And I'm talking about Owen Colfer.
I knew as soon as you said laptop. He's always going into restaurants on his own with his laptop to write. Yeah, yeah. Usually drinking a glass of rosé, I might point out.
Well, it was coffee time at this point. But yes, I know what you're saying. But so what's the connection between, because we're now heading towards Wexford together.
Yeah,
let's do that.
Yeah. Owen and I were in the same class in school. So I've known him since he was a kid. He was the kid, the annoying kid sitting beside me who would never pay attention to the teacher because he was always drawing these amazing action figures, and he'd ignore the class for the whole year and then get an A plus while I got the C minus consistently, even though I tried really hard. So
he sounds like a delightful person.
Super annoying, but it makes me laugh more than anybody else I know. And we eventually got to work together a couple of years ago, and yeah, he's the best in the world.
Okay, and then, so we went from chips to Wexford. And Owen, obviously, who we love and admire. And then you said to me, oh, you heard you were in Wexford this week. I said, yeah, I drove down quickly. There was a lovely girl called Una Walsh who played the harp in the toy show. And you immediately said?
Yeah, I've known Una since she was a little baby. Her mum, Barbara, is a great friend of mine. I'm a big trad head. I love all things opera in Wexford, but all things traditional music as well. And so we are both consumed with traditional music.
Amazing.
And Una is just a pleasure and we're super proud of her. Yeah. And
she's a star.
She's actually, I'm going to have her on my TV show this season.
We'll talk about that.
Yeah.
I didn't know the connection was there either.
Right.
And actually, Una's mother, as you mentioned, as I was leaving, there was talk of the Fla coming to Wexford. And
yeah, we've been planning it for several years. I think the first conversation I had with Barbara about 20 years ago, we were like, when are we going to get the Fla to Wexford? And it might now be in the distance.
Oh, great.
I'll be home for that. And
But Wexford has so much to offer. I mean, as I was driving down, I was thinking of Vinegar Hill, and I was stopped in Enniscorthy, and I was thinking of Colum Tabine and Brooklyn. And, you know, I can see why it would be. And then I bought the strawberries on the side of the road.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah,
and apple juice and everything like that. And then I put it up on Instagram, and suddenly all these kind of Wexford Tourist Board and Wexford Food Board were kind of hooking in. And I like that they did that. They're like, it's buzzy. I like when a town, you know,
yeah,
says,
there's a
right,
buzz around the town. I think that we realised what we had about maybe 10 or 15 years ago and finally started to sing it from the treetops. You know, the opera festivals means that we have a very long tourist season right through to November. But we never really owned it until maybe recently. And now, of course, aside from half of Dublin who comes down to Carraclough, now everybody else is finding out about it, including North America, which is...
So that's another link.
Yeah.
We've loads of places to go here. So what I'm going to do is ask you about the fact that... I think your mother was a singer. Was she a great singer?
Yeah. So my mother's a Carty. The Carty family in Wexford. Big, big family. She had 11 brothers and sisters. My earliest memory is them all singing together. I was stood in front of me granny when I was 5 and I was told to sing or get out of the house. So I hadn't a choice. Yeah.
And Ryan asked Michael about playing Bobby Kennedy in JFK the musical.
A disaster. Like, it was my first musical. It was horrendous.
Yeah.
But I didn't know that, like, there was like 13 Tony winners.
In the
production team, like major people. I had no idea what I was doing and was very lucky to kind of get the job. And it kind of just started a career that really just, I'm so lucky that it hasn't stopped. I haven't been unemployed yet.
Well, that's a really interesting thing that the show kind of died a death. But you didn't and your career didn't.
Yeah, well, you know, even though I've been a singer my whole life, and purely because of that and the ensuing jobs, including Riverdance on Broadway, which probably was my calling card in America, you know, while I sing and I sing well and that's great, I have a much bigger interest in everything around theatre and projects around theatre. And my producer job really kind of took over, and I fulfilled the dream that I kind of always wanted to achieve, was to be a producer in New York and produce shows.
And along the way, before we get to the producer world, you mentioned Riverdance.
Yeah.
You were singing there. You took over from, Brian Kennedy?
I did, yeah. I was Brian's understudy in New York. And then when he finished, then I took over the job as lead singer, which was... It was incredible, you know, to be singing 8 shows a week in the Gershwin on Broadway. Oh. And I certainly kind of, while I loved it and I loved being a singer, it kind of doubled down my interest in what I wanted to do for the rest of my days. And I kind of ultimately decided I was going to stay in America then once I finished on Broadway.
Really? Put the anchor down?
Yeah.
Big risk, but you had the talent.
Oh, major gamble.
Yeah.
And of course, it's all about trying to get the visa. And, you know, I spent about 5 years after that doing everything I could to try and get the visa. And luckily I managed to get it.
Because I would have thought it was like not a shark pool, but certainly a really hard place to break into.
Yeah. I mean, Broadway is terrifying. And ultimately, as a singer, I didn't find it very fulfilling.
Yeah.
But what I wanted to do was learn about theatre in New York. And it's big business and it is terrifying, but thrilling at the same time. So I just became more and more obsessed with it.
So where did your production days begin then?
You know, about 5 years after Riverdance, you know, it was really difficult to kind of carve out a solo career. I was that nameless singer who sang while the dancers were changing their shoes. You know, nobody came to hear a singer. And I just learned about the business. And I think that's probably the key to success in the US, you know, is learning the framework and understanding how to kind of propel yourself forward. And I just gradually kind of bit by bit, year by year. And
what were you producing? Or
I was producing. I was producing tours, concert tours, other artists, and kind of smaller musicals. That kind of. Those kind of, we scaled up over the years.
And Ryan asked about the TV programme called Ireland with Michael.
4 years ago, maybe 3 years ago, it was just the very start of COVID, just before COVID actually, I was filming a concert down at the National Opera House. We started filming outside the town because obviously I'm passionate about Wexford and I want people to learn about it. We've kind of lost out to the west of Ireland in North America. And so we sent some of the concert footage and the outside footage to PBS and they said, well, do you want to keep doing this? And so we filmed 6 episodes and they loved it. And we're now at the end of season 2, in the middle of season 3. We're in 80% of people's houses in North America.
Amazing.
And it's
Ireland with Michael.
It's Ireland with Michael. Essentially, it's the best of what Ireland has to offer. But I've called in every favour from people.
Give me a typical example of a show.
We're down in Dingle.
Okay.
And so we did all of the sites you see in Dingle.
Lovely.
But also then I knew that Johnny Madden was up the road. Johnny Madden, a marvellous traditional whistle player. I got her. We filmed her at her house. I knew that I represent actually Nathan Carter in North America. So I got Nathan Carter to come and sing a song. I've had a Bioga. We've everybody from Gavin Ring, the opera singer, to Sasha Tarfus, the poet laureate down in Wexford, young trad bands who would never ever have a hope of getting on American TV. I just want to, that's what Ireland's finest talent is. And it's the reason why people are interested in Ireland. It's not just the castles and the scenery.
Yes.
It's Ireland's best asset is our artists. And that's kind of what
so
I want to
highlight. You're showcasing a lot of these artists. I like the fact that you're probably mixing the traditional, and I don't mean that musically, but the artists we were used to seeing with all these new youngsters who are so impressive.
Absolutely. Even bigger acts, like the High Kings who tour, they're not seen on regular TV over there.
Yes.
So I want to highlight the well-known artists, but also people that you'd never even heard of. I just filmed an amazing young band from the south of Wexford called Tulua. They're like 17 and 18 year olds. Fantastic playing and beautiful. And people in North America really want to hear it.
And it's working. You're getting that response. What are they saying about the program?
The greatest thing that we're doing is we're getting all these messages from all over North America, people who say, well, we didn't really, they're learning what real Ireland is like, and it's not shamrocks and shillelaghs. Tourism Ireland work with me over in North America. Aer Lingus and CIE Tours are our sponsors on the show. And we project a very kind of, it's a collaborative effort. We project a very modern, fresh vision of what Ireland is now.
Sounds great. Congratulations.
Thanks.
It's kind of gratifying to hear that, I feel kind of, most people do, proprietorial about how the country is represented abroad. You just don't want it to be hokey or embarrassing. It sounds like you've got that lovely balance and mix, which is great.
I watch it from a very objective point of view from the Midwest where I live.
Yes.
So I really am very picky about how the country looks.
Michael Launder from The Ryan Tuberty Show. So it was week 4 of business journalist Adam Maguire's inflation shopping basket, and this time it was loo roll and jeans.
So Adam, we've covered the pasta, the coffee, the biscuits, the tomato and the cooking oil.
All still in the shopping basket.
They're all still there in the basket, but you have a few more things in there for us to look at today. What have you got?
That's right. So we've got toilet roll, loo roll, bog roll, whatever you call it.
An essential,
yeah. I think no home should be without it. And we also have jeans.
Okay.
Now, pair of jeans
shopping
there.
Baskets, supermarkets,
well,
jeans.
It's not an everyday item, but a lot of shopping supermarkets sell clothes now.
Yeah.
So you could go and do your weekly shop and pick up a pair of jeans or an item of clothing. But it is representing all clothing, socks, pants, everything else.
We went for milk the other night and we ended up buying shorts, children's shorts.
Yeah.
So it does happen.
It's not unusual to come home with a pair of something or other from your weekly shop.
So they're included.
We think it's fair.
Just on the toilet rolls, we got a text to the programme last week when you said that you were going to be covering this topic. So let's bring you this
one, Anna. Yesterday I went to buy my usual own brand toilet rolls. 9 rolls normally cost €2.79. That price has risen to €4.50. I then went to another shop. Their 9 pack of toilet rolls had risen from €2.29 to €3.50. These are scary increases. So now, as well as telling the kids to turn off the lights, eat less, we'll also have to tell them about how much toilet roll they can use or get a bidet. Ew. So Anna wants to know what's driving the price increase.
Yeah. In terms of the price increase, fairly dramatic there. I think it's like 50 to 100% kind of increases. Huge, that listener's talking about. So it depends on the brand and everything else. Figures from Nielsen IQ say toilet paper prices are up 15.6% in the year to May, which is way above the general increase in consumer goods. The listener, as I said, seeing much bigger increases. What could be muddying the water here is the fact that, as you might know, toilet roll is often one of those things that's on a special offer in a supermarket. So you buy a big multiple pack and you get it at a relatively cheap price. Once prices start to go up on the cost of things for a retailer, they tend to stop putting things on special offer. So what happens then is that you have to pay the full price and maybe now an inflated full price. So you're getting hit on the double, essentially. It seems like a much more dramatic price increase than what is actually happening. And unfortunately for the listener and for the rest of us, the price is going to go up more, essentially. Kimberly Clark, the company that makes Andrex and Kleenex, along with a huge number of other brands, says it's going to start pushing through a mid to high single digit percentage increase next month. So you can see that as 5 to 9% increase on the price they're charging. Essity, which makes the Cashel brand, also said earlier this year it's going to have to start raising prices in its products. So the price is going to keep going up in the near
future.
So they're
going to keep going up. Despite what Anna has seen already, we're going to see further increases.
Yeah, more than likely. And then maybe with own brand stuff, they might just put the price in and then try and keep it there because it's a value proposition. But generally speaking, the price is going to go up a bit more.
So can you give us more detail then on why specifically toilet roll is increasing by so much? I mean, the average you mentioned there, over 15%. That's much higher than the other products we've been talking about.
Yeah, it's 3 or 4 times the rate that we see in general across the grocery market. So companies that are making toilet paper, they're facing the same issues that the rest of us are: higher fuel costs, higher transportation costs. But there is a very specific reason for toilet roll prices going up. It has a positive angle, but it also has a massive downside too, which is that we have to pay more. So we know that companies of all stripes across the board are trying to make their products more sustainable now. And a big part of that push is to reduce the amount of plastic or styrofoam and so on that you use in the product or use in the packaging. And that means they're switching over to paper and cardboard instead. It's easier to recycle. It doesn't leach out harmful chemicals like plastics and styrofoam tends to do. And at the end of its life, unlike plastic, it can biodegrade. So it's much better for the environment. At the same time, we've also started online shopping a lot more the last 2 years because of the pandemic. Huge increase in the amount of online shopping, and that means we need more cardboard and more packaging to put all those products in and ship them across the country or across the world. And all of that's pushed up the price of pulp, which is the raw material that paper and cardboard is made from. It's been rising steadily since 2017, but it's really, really jumped in the last few months. Apparently, the price per ton of wood pulp jumped from just over $600 in September to more than $900 last month. So a 50% increase in, 6 or 7 months. And the big problem for consumers is pulp is also what's used to make household products like toilet paper. So it's essentially gotten swept up in this move to sustainability and online shopping.
And to the jeans and the price of clothing.
How much is the price of clothing increasing by, Adam?
According to the Central Statistics Office, their consumer price data for April said the price of clothing was 1.1% higher in the year. So not too dramatic. But it also showed that prices had jumped by 4.2% in the month from April to March. So a huge jump in just a couple of weeks. Footwear prices, meanwhile, up more than 6% in the past year. And what that points to is that we're starting now to see price increases that have been flagged by the major retailers. So pretty much all of the big guys have said that they're upping prices, whether you're talking about Inditex, which owns brands like Zara, Primark, which of course owns Penny's here, H&M, Next, all planning price increases. Some are already happening or are just feeding through, as we see in the April data. Others, though, coming down the line. Penny's, for example, is going to increase prices on its autumn winter stock. So we'll see that in August.
I think when we heard from Penny's that they were going to increase their prices. I mean, for them to say that in the way that they did means that it's going to be probably pretty hefty.
Yeah, and prices is a big part of their business model. So they're very reluctant to raise prices if they don't have to. Next, for example, is going to raise prices in the second half of the year. They're talking about 6.5% increase. So that's what we're going to see in the coming months, is the price of clothing going up a bit more.
So what are the retailers saying then about the increase in the cost? What's it down to?
Well, we spoke last week about that wonderful global supply chain for all these products, a lot of these things, like be it pasta or coffee beans in particular as well, and the cookies we use as an example of how all these things come from all around the world and can be done quite cheaply normally. But because of the pandemic, that supply chain is broken. And for most of the big brands, be it on the mass market side or the high-end luxury side in clothing, their goods are being produced in the likes of China, India, Vietnam. I checked these jeans. They're made in Pakistan. So all coming from various parts of the world.
Yep, long way to travel.
Yeah, shipped across and sold in a shop in somewhere like Ireland. So when the pandemic hit, the factories were shut down, the ports were shut down, and we're still dealing with the backlog that was created by that. But, you know, there's also other things as well. For example, you know, fuel costs, energy costs, all of those things are feeding in as well. And it means that if your shipping goes from around the world, it's going to cost you a lot more.
So is the converse of that true, that if you're buying Irish made clothes, and is there an advantage there for the Irish producers? If you're buying the Irish made clothes, are they cheaper because they have less of a journey to make?
Well, not really, because even if they're making the clothes here, the chances are they're having to import the materials to make the clothes. So most cotton comes from the US or Brazil. Wool might be coming from Australia or South Africa, China. Is where you get denim, linen, polyester. So bar maybe companies might be using Irish wool or, you know, high-end linen or high-end leather from Italy, which would obviously be more expensive to start with. Chances are that they're also facing the same shipping issues to get stuff out of around the world.
I just want to move on to this clothing company that is trying to be sustainable. This is an Irish company, isn't it, you spoke to?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so this is an Irish-based company, just to get an idea of what they're doing, because they're trying to be more sustainable. Irish Society, based in Galway. They've been up and running for 5 years. People might be aware of them. They sell kind of colourful, funny socks with Irish-specific designs. So you can have county-specific socks or ones with Sherlocket or Grand on the foot of them. Their ultimate aim is to make the socks here as well, but they can't do that at the moment. For the time being, though, they're keeping production in the EU. So they're trying to make sure they're not shipping things from all around the world. They're also using sustainable cotton, recycled and recyclable packaging as well. And according to co-founder Joanna Sheska, she said that all of those decisions come at a cost.
Oh, the difference is big, you know, because like all of our packaging is recycled or compostable. So the price is so much higher when compared to regular plastic bags or whatever else you like. Again, to marketing materials, from our newsletters to any catalogs, and everything is printed on recycled paper. So it is always a difference, I would say, about 30% at least more that we have to pay compared to regular materials. Like if you compare our prices, our socks have €9 in shop, and then if you go to, you know, a chain shop and you can get socks for five pairs for a fiver. So that's the difference, you know, because it's not only about making money. It is about making money, obviously, because we want to survive. We want to create jobs. You know, we want to make a living. So that's obviously the first goal. But at the same time, we don't want to take advantage of the environment. We don't want to take the advantage of the community. We do want to support the local business, the local community. And we genuinely, again, are so impressed with Ireland that we do want to support it.
It costs these companies to be sustainable or to attempt to be sustainable.
Absolutely. I mean, you heard there that you're talking about 20 to 30% increase on the packaging if you want to be sustainable, as opposed to just going for the cheap and cheerful stuff. And depending on how sustainable you want to be, the cost just is going to tick up. So it means so much. So at the very least, it means, you know, you're no longer finding the cheapest supplier of whatever material you're using. Instead, you're focused on making sure that the people who are growing or harvesting or producing or manufacturing are treated well and they're paid properly. You have to make sure that the product itself isn't harming the environment, so you're avoiding plastic-based material like polyester or nylon in favour of natural materials like cotton, going for maybe better quality dyes. Maybe you want to ensure you're using renewable energy or offsetting the carbon on the production. And maybe you want to set up what's called a closed loop system. Some retailers doing this, where you can bring back your old clothes that are beyond their life and they get recycled in some way as well. And each of those things that you do is going to add a little bit of a cost. But beyond that, sustainability is also about trying to get more out of the things that you're buying as well. And part of that is on the consumer to try and, you know, not just
extend
wear something
life
once and throw it out. But it's also on the retailer, because you need to make sure that the clothes are well made.
Adam McGuire from Today with Claire Byrne. And on the live line with Katie Hannan, the affordability of fertility treatment. Claire called Katie.
Claire, you are trying for a baby?
I am.
And it's not cheap.
It is not cheap, no. It certainly is not cheap.
Tell us a little bit about yourself, Claire. Have you been on this journey, is that the way we put it these days, for some time, or where are you at?
Yeah, so we've been trying like consistently since around November 2020, because I had a miscarriage in November 2020. So we started originally in March 2020, but it's been consistent since November 2020. And so that's about a year and a half now straight.
Or 18 months, as
18 months, yeah.
As you will have been counting it.
Yeah.
So how is it? How are you about this? Like, how are you in your head about this?
I thought it was kind of a hard question to answer, I suppose. It's a very frustrating process. And, you know, there's only kind of so much that you can control in it, I suppose. So you have to sort of let it go a bit. And just be like, you know, what will happen. But then I suppose the longer that you go trying, you're like more willing to try stuff, if you know what I mean. And so you kind of, you're like, okay, that hasn't worked, so we're going to try something else. And you're just sort of, yeah, you're pulling at strings, I suppose, to try and figure out what on earth you can do to help this process move along.
Okay, so
it's also quite a lonely process, I guess. Like, I think I'm very talkative and very outspoken about the fact that we're going through this, which has been great for me, because actually loads of people have talked to me and said, well, actually, we had similar issues and you wouldn't have known it just from, like, Instagram or whatever. So, like, that has actually been amazing, because it is a very lonely process to go through.
Yeah, and going back to our opening point, can be quite expensive. So talk me through some of the things you have now entered into your life since you've started down this road.
Yeah, so what happened to me recently was I basically had like a kind of straw that broke the camel's back moment. And that was because there's a lot of costs that are, you know, involved in trying to have a baby. And then there's also a lot of hidden costs as well. And so, as I said, they kind of build up then as well. So, I mean, obviously, when you're trying for baby, you're going to budget for things that you know are coming. So things like GP visits, tests, all those kind of things, blood tests. You're going to budget for them because you know that they're going to come up. But then there's like other kind of slightly more hidden costs. I feel like everything that has the word conception on it is like double the price of the thing next to it on the shelf. There's like ovulation sticks. There's pregnancy tests. There's medicines that you might have to go on.
And how much does this stuff cost for people who are not out there looking at this stuff? Like, how much is an ovulation sticks, a pack of ovulation sticks?
Yeah, so and there are cheaper ways to do it, I guess. But for me, I did originally bulk buy my ovulation test on Amazon, thinking this is great, now I'll save money. But somebody told me that they're not as accurate, so you have to get the digital ones. So then I went into the pharmacy to get the digital ones. So the digital ones are €40 a packet, and they, you know, will only last one cycle, so that's about €40 a month. So then you're spending, you know, whatever, I'd say minimum €20 a month on your pregnancy tests. And then I'm on a medicine to help me ovulate.
Okay, we're at,
well,
okay,
so.
I'm just adding it up here. That's, we're at €60 now. And
I'm on a medicine to help me ovulate. And that probably works out about €10 a month, which is, you know,
okay,
affordable. But you add that on to your
€70. We're up at 70.
And I've been recommended acupuncture as well. So acupuncture, as far as I know, is around €70 a session.
€140. Yeah. If you only go once a month.
I don't know how many sessions you need a month now. You might need two. Like, I'm investigating that at the
minute. We're up to 210.
And then, so, of course, then you've got your other things, like you've got your GP visits, which would be €60 a pop, blood tests. I've had, like, blood tests. Yeah, I've had blood tests that cost kind of 15 or whatever, and then I've had blood tests that cost 85.
Okay, we're well over, we've broken through the €300 mark now,
yeah.
Claire.
And so but as I said, I totally understand that, yeah, you're budgeting for tests and stuff coming up. Like, I've been recommended two more tests. One will be 125, the next one will be 400. So there's certain tests you budget for and certain big expenditures you budget for. But the straw that broke the camel's back moment for me was that I got prescribed these supplements. And as far as I can tell, they're just just supplements for when you're trying to have a baby. And I went into
what
the
kind
pharmacy.
Of things, like vitamins, or do you know what's in them?
So I don't know what's in them. I don't really even know like what they're for, what they do, or because I haven't had a test to say like to check if I'm missing low in this or high on that or whatever. So I don't even. It wasn't really explained to me like why I needed them, but I just went in with my prescription and they were €140. And
for how many? For how long would that last you?
So this is the thing. So I paid for it and then I went out to my car and realised that I was thinking it's a one-off cost, like, you know, just we'll eat it and move on. But it was actually only for a 30-day supply.
Well, that's Claire. Then Robert called with his experience of fertility treatment.
About 5 years of our life was taken up with trying to have babies. We basically ran out of time. So we went for all the treatments, IUI first, then IVF, a few cycles of IVF, which were all unsuccessful. The cost of those were roughly about, I think, in total about $20,000. Then our option was really to travel outside the country and try and get a donor egg, which we did. So there's initial consultation with your consultants, et cetera, which is obviously costly. There's all the medication you've got to put up with your wife and injector, et cetera, and all the trauma and pain that causes, and the potential danger for the future for her. She's getting older, mm-hmm. the legacy of that whole ordeal. We were basically given the option to go to the States. So we took it, over to Maryland, and we went over. We were fortunate to be able to afford it, to be honest. You know, we put a lot of our lives on hold. You know, we lived in an unrenovated house for six years or so. Drove old cars, didn't eat particularly well.
Let's just call that one out, actually, Robert, because, you know, you say you were able to afford it and people say you're very, very lucky that you were in that position. But you made huge sacrifices in other parts of your life to allow yourself to do this.
I gave up drinks and cigarettes, so I didn't have that expense. We didn't socialise. Literally, it was all about having babies. And every resource we had went into that.
I must have been the strain of all of that, though, that huge laser focus on this one, you know, possibly unachievable dream, this one thing you both want so badly. It must have put a lot of strain on the relationship.
When your wife, when the person you love turns to you and says, "I don't want to die alone," it doesn't matter what impediments is put in front of you, you'll absolutely try your damnedest to do it for her, which is what I did.
And we should tell people that there is a happy ending. You were successful, which is fantastic.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, $80,000 later, okay? So
$80,000, wow.
$80,000 later. Now, we got some of that back. The trip to the USA was, I think, about €55,000. So the other treatments we had made up the difference there. We got some of that back because there's a revenue thing where you can claim for a procedure which can't be done in the country. Mm-hmm. You can claim some of it back. It's put back on your tax, et cetera, that. But I'm not sure the quantities, what we got back. Really, we didn't care at that stage. We were delighted. We were pregnant with twins after miscarriages, after, you know, we had to do two trips to the USA to get pregnant. We went once. She was implanted. She got a miscarriage. And then we get back for, and we said, listen, put two embryos in. This is our last shot.
And it really was your last shot that.
Well, I mean, the last $10,000 we had to come up with, it took us a year to get it.
We scraped it together,
we did. And now I'm the proud father of twin boys. They're 4 years of age. They're starting school in September. It's been a roller coaster.
Oh, my God. Such precious boys.
I'll tell you this thing, Katie. I've been judged by people in my family and who said, well, they're not really your children, la-da-dee-da-da-da. They are my children, yeah, and they are my wife's children. She carried them. They're my genes. She carried them. She did everything that was... She did more than any mother, possibly, in history. I would actually think of that. Think of the length that we had to go through to come up with that amount of money.
Absolutely.
And work. And all that, and take the time off that's needed. I mean, it's a pretty, pretty, you know, damning sort of condemnation of the Irish Health Board, to be honest, as well, that we don't provide that. I mean, I'm raising two taxpayers, two men who will go on and inherit what we have and will contribute to the society. They're bright and beautiful boys. And yet the Irish state doesn't seem to be particularly interested. But yet they will be very interested when they start paying, you know, when they start paying tax. They'll be extremely interested for the rest of their lives.
That's Robert on the live line with Katie Hannan. And on Today with Clare Byrne, Irish writer Dervla McTiernan was talking about her new book, The Murder Rule. And as Clare pointed out, it's doing very, very well.
Listen, the book is number one in Australia. Yeah. It's phenomenal.
3 weeks now, number one, which has never happened to me before. It's been amazing.
And you have a TV deal for this one.
I do. It's FX, which is part of Disney, is adapting it for a limited series.
How exciting.
Amazing.
Can you believe it?
I can't believe it. I mean, I can't believe it. But I can't believe any of this. The whole journey has been a bit surreal. Mm.
But one of your other books, The Ruin, I mean, that's been optioned, hasn't it?
Yeah, that's been optioned. It was optioned by Hopscotch Features, and then Colin Farrell has set up his own production company, so he wanted to get involved and have that as one of his first projects.
Mm-hmm. And when did the writing start for you? Because this wasn't always what you did.
No, I was a lawyer for a long time, and we left Australia, or left Ireland for Australia in 2011. Now, I had a baby very quickly after that, and he didn't sleep for a few years. That slowed me down. But in 2014, I decided, look, I'm going to give this a go. If I don't, I'll always regret not trying. Mm-hmm. But with any career change, you know, you commit a lot of time to it. So I said, I'll give it 5 years. I started writing every night except Thursday nights, which was wine night. You can't mess with that. And
were you still working away then?
I was working, yeah. I was working and the kids were very small. But the writing was always my time. It was my time at the end of the day, you know. And so I signed my first contract with HarperCollins in October 2016. And The Ruin came out in 2018. And it's just been go-go
and
since.
Onwards from there.
Yeah.
So had you always had the writing in the back of your mind as this is something I would like to do at some point in the future?
In all honesty, no.
Really?
I know an awful lot of writers say I've always wanted to be a writer. It's not that I wouldn't have loved it. It just felt like it was something for other people. I loved books so much. I think I thought of writers as just sort of magicians, like they could just do it. I didn't understand that it was a craft, like you had to put in the work and that it took time and rewriting to be good. So I just thought that would never be me. Mm-hmm. And then it was only when everything, you know, we really struggled towards the end of our time in Ireland after the crash, the economic crash. And, you know, we tried really hard to kind of do everything according to the rules and it hadn't worked. And so then going to Australia was this sort of freedom for us in a way. We could try anything we wanted to and not feel bad about it.
So was post-crash Ireland the reason why you left? It was just too difficult to move on from it, or?
I had a little practice in the West and it was doing great. And then it really wasn't during in the aftermath of the crash. And, you know, clients needed you probably more than ever, but they weren't in a position to pay their bills through no fault of their own. It just got harder to make ends meet until it became impossible. And I was also very burned out, you know, really burned out and really struggling just mentally and emotionally. I guess a lot of us were at that stage. And I just knew I could never practice law again. So we went to Australia really kind of with fingers and toes crossed, hoping to start anew.
And Claire is a big fan of the book.
I'm not surprised that this has been optioned because it reads like a script. It's just rock and roll. You can't. It's one of those ones. I've been up late every night this week reading this book. I normally am asleep before 11. I haven't been asleep before 11 any night because this thing is like rock and roll. Next chapter, next chapter, next chapter. So we've got Hannah, who is managed to inveigle her way into the Innocence Project, working for them, and she's a law student. She is the main character, but we don't really like her. Was that fair? I'm not sure whether
no,
I like her or not.
You're not the first person to say that. A lot of people say, oh, I'm not sure I like that Hannah girl. And I sort of do like her a lot, actually. But she's a bit of wish fulfillment for me. I hesitate to admit that because she's quite ruthless.
Mm-hmm. She is.
But when I was a young lawyer, I really second-guessed myself a lot. Like a lot of young women did in those days. You know, we sort of think, did I do that right? Was that received well? You know, all this kind of monologue in your head. It's such a waste of time. It took me a long time to grow out of that. Hannah's not like that at all. Like she knows she's good at things. Where she goes wrong is that she's utterly convinced she's right about things.
Yes.
So yeah, she's a mixed bag in the beginning. But I think there are reasons that she is the way she is. And I think she grows up a lot over the course of the story.
And will you explain to our listeners what the murder rule is?
Yeah, the murder rule refers to the felony murder rule, which is this weird little bit of law that says if you commit a felony and there's a death during the felony, you can be held responsible for murder. So, you know, it has resulted in some really odd convictions in the States in particular. So there's one situation where a guy committed an armed robbery, pretty serious offence, but he was caught, he was arrested, he was handcuffed, he was put in the back of the police car. And while he was handcuffed in the back of the police car, the police officer shot his accomplice dead, his friend. And the guy still in handcuffs was found guilty of that murder, because it was in the course of a felony. Another situation where a young man was at a party, he's having a few drinks. Friend of a friend asked if he could borrow the car. He said, yeah, okay, no problem. Went home, went to bed, and he was arrested, convicted and jailed for felony murder. Because the guy who borrowed the car went to a woman's house, broke in. She was there with a male friend. There was a fight and he killed the friend. And it was held that the person who had lent the car knew that he might break in. He wanted to get his stuff back. There was a whole backstory to it. But the point of this, the rule is, it sort of removes this link between cause and effect that is at the heart of law. When I was a young lawyer, we were taught, you know, to be criminally responsible for an act, you must have both committed it and intended to commit it. And this is not that. So it really fit the story for a lot of reasons. Firstly, because there's a case a bit like that in the story, but also because I was really interested for Hannah. You know, to what degree is she responsible for the outcome of the kind of ruthless acts she takes? Mm-hmm. Is she responsible for everything, whether or not she could foresee it? Should she have foreseen those things? So I was sort of playing around with that idea a bit.
Debra McTiernan, the book is called The Murder Rule, from Today with Claire Byrne. And on the Ray Darcy Show, some of the Irish people who were featured on the Ellen DeGeneres Show through the years on the last day of her show.
Ellen DeGeneres has her last show. It's been broadcast in the States. She's done 3,000 episodes and that's going to air today. The show was once the biggest daytime show in the US, but suffered after Ellen DeGeneres, you know, she was putting out the image of being kind, and then there were allegations of a toxic work environment, and some of her employees came forward and made allegations against her. Anyway, among the 4,000 guests that Ellen has had on the show over the years, several Irish people have featured, including Keith Barry, Busker Ali Sherlock, we've had her on the show, Crystal Swing were on it, Jamie Dornan, Dermot Kennedy, Saoirse Ronan. They've all been guests of Ellen DeGeneres over the years. So just a reminder, this is Ellen with Ali, yeah.
When I saw a video of our next guest singing on the streets of Dublin, I knew I had to meet her from Cork, Ireland. Please welcome 12-year-old Ali Sherlock.
And getting on Ellen DeGeneres was a big thing. And I think Ali Sherlock is still reaping the benefits of that.
I think you've been there you go.
That's
times.
Ali. And then Crystal Swing.
I mean, coming on your show, Ellen, has been probably the biggest highlight of our life to date. Yeah. You know, it's
that's Mary there.
It's like a dream.
From the Ray Darcy Show. And that's it for Playback Daily. So mind yourself till next time.